Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio.
Donald Trump says he's safe and well after what the FBI says appears to be another attempted assassination on the former president at his Florida golf course. Sheriff Rick Bradshaw praised the work of law enforcement.
The Secret Service and the FBI have been fantastic to work. And I can tell you right now, our agency with this real-time crime center was fabulous. That's how we got the guy. We started out with, we don't know anything, to where we had a tag, we had a vehicle description.
Former BBC presenter Hugh Edwards is due to be sentenced for accessing indecent images of children as young as seven. The veteran broadcaster admitted three charges of making indecent photographs after he was sent 41 illegal images by a convicted paedophile. An independent commission hearing to examine alleged breaches of the Premier League's financial regulations by Manchester City begins later. The champions are facing 115 charges of breaking the competition's rules. And tributes are being paid to Tito Jackson, who has died aged 70. From Radio News Hub, I'm Grace McIntosh.
Book now for summer 2025 with EasyJet Holidays. With up to £200 off package holidays, you can save on our already unbeatable prices. Search EasyJet Holidays or see your local travel agent. Selected dates up to the 31st of the 10th, 25. Book by 11 p.m. the 16th to the 9th, 24. See price guarantee online. Minimum spend. Atal protected. T's and C's apply.
Coming up, metaphorically speaking.
I never thought of myself as the giving type, but I guess I am. I give my elderly neighbour's dog a walk every night, despite its barking being my alarm clock every morning. And I give blood when I can, because it helps combat cancer. It takes an hour and saves lives, like my mum's, who was here long enough to see her grandson take his first steps.
Kaya!
Coming! And she's still here. If you're the giving type, join the thousands of us giving blood every day. Book now at blood.co.uk.
Live on DAB Digital Radio, Colorful.com, and apps. This is Colorful Radio. Colorful.
Colorful. Delia. Colorful. 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 Colorful Radio.
Hello and welcome to Metaphorically Speaking with me, Delia Delore. The show where we dissect popular mottos, mantras, and metaphors, tracing their origins and finding how they translate to everyday life. Each week, we have a special guest who resonates with their chosen expression. Our metaphor this week is one that you would have heard. It's something that you would have mentioned when something was more expensive than you think it would be. Do you care to guess? So earlier on in the show, what the metaphor would be? My guest today is Char Hibbert. She's a money mindset and NLP coach, so she knows exactly what she's talking about. Today, we'll look at the metaphor, cost an arm and a leg, a phrase commonly used to describe something extremely expensive. But where did it come from? And why is it so macabre? To cost an arm and a leg is a hyperbolic way of saying that something is exorbitant. It's not a phrase you use to describe something that's annoyingly overpriced, like a latte, but rather something of great cost, like a luxury car, or, in my opinion, air travel fees. Well, it depends on the airline, doesn't it? So how did this over-the-top metaphor make its way to our lexicon? Well, there are two competing theories around the saying's origin. The first theory is that the phrase relates to 18th century portraiture. Supposedly, arms and legs were difficult to paint, and it was hard for the painter to capture the proportions correctly. Therefore, artists charged more for a full-body portrait, costing the patron an arm and a leg. According to this idea, a painting showing no limbs would cost less, which is why you often saw subjects with a hand tucked into a vest or their legs covered by drapery. Did you know that? I didn't. Here's how the YouTube channel Fun Facts Fiesta explains it.
Ever wondered why something costs an arm and a leg? It traces back to a time when portraits were a status symbol, but not all limbs were created equal in art. Back in the days, painters charged by limb, painting a face was standard, adding hands or limbs up the price. To flaunt wealth, nobles would splurge on full-figure portraits. The intricate detailing of limbs took time, skill, and thus more money. Having both arms and legs in a painting wasn't a casual choice. It was a declaration of opulence. Now translate that to modern terms. Paying an arm and a leg implies a cost so steep, it's like giving up parts of yourself. It's no wonder the phrase stuck. So, the next time you hear it cost an arm and a leg, remember it's not just about price, but also the bygone era's symbol of wealth and extravagance.
There are parts of this theory that do sound a bit odd. Would military generals and noblemen be concerned with getting a deal on their portraits? Would they sit for a painter who couldn't properly paint arms, legs, or hands? It's not uncommon in early portraiture to see men with their hand tucked into their waistcoat. The hand in waistcoat pose was common in 18th and 19th century portraiture. A favorite of Napoleon Bonaparte, the pose was meant to convey leadership and indicated that the subject was upper class. Supposedly, the pose goes all the way back to ancient Greece, when the orator Aeschines said that restricting the movement of one hand was the formal way to speak in public. Generally, these portraits employ great attention to detail and were obviously painted by expert painters. Speaking of expert painters, it is interesting that the most famous painting in the world, which would cost an arm and a leg, depicts arms but no legs.
Men have named you. You're so like the lady with a mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile? Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart? Many dreams have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there and they die there. Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art.
That was Nat King Cole's 1950 classic Mona Lisa. The Mona Lisa, Leonardo da Vinci's masterpiece, completed sometime between 1503 and 1529, receives over 6 million visitors per year. Though it is priceless, the painting holds the Guinness World Book for the highest known painting insurance valuation, which was $100 million in 1962. Today, that is equivalent to about $1 billion, or almost £800 million. And since the Mona Lisa has been part of the Louvre's collection since 1804, it's safe to say she won't be up for sale anytime soon. It is interesting that the Mona Lisa only became famous after it was stolen in 1911 by Louvre employee Vincenzo Perugia. It makes you wonder, had the painting not been stolen and the subject of international media attention, will it still cost an arm and a leg? Granted, the painting was a literal work of art, with Da Vinci's early use of atmospheric perspective, in which he gave background images a hazy look to imply depth. He also used the fumato technique, using fine shading to soften the edges of features as a way to define them without the use of lines. This TED Talk video explains how the Mona Lisa rose to fame.
By the 20th century, the portrait was an iconic piece in one of the world's most famous museums. But the Mona Lisa wasn't yet a household name. It was Perugia's 1911 heist that helped it skyrocket to unprecedented fame. Having been contracted to make protective cases for the Louvre, it wasn't totally inconceivable for Perugia to be locked inside the museum. And lucky for him, when a workman encountered him in the stairwell, he simply helped Perugia open the door and let him walk out into the morning. The theft made international headlines. People gathered to see the blank space where the Mona Lisa once hung. The police interviewed Perugia because he had worked at the Louvre, but they never considered him a suspect. Meanwhile, they interrogated Pablo Picasso because of his connection to a previous Louvre theft, but eventually let him go. For 2 years, Perugia kept the painting in a false-bottom suitcase, then smuggled the Mona Lisa to Italy and arranged to sell it to a Florentine art dealer. Perugia saw himself as an Italian patriot, returning an old master's work. But instead of being celebrated as such, he was immediately arrested. With the mystery solved, the Mona Lisa went back on display to large crowds, and newspapers took the story for a victory lap. In the following decades, conceptual artist Marcel Duchamp mocked it, Nazi art thieves pursued it, Nat King Cole sang about it, and museum-goers wielding stones, paint, acid, and teacups attacked it. More than 500 years after its creation, eyebrows and eyelashes long since faded, the Mona Lisa is protected by a bulletproof, earthquake-safe case. Now, it stands perhaps less as an exemplary Renaissance portrait and more as a testament to how we create and maintain celebrity.
While some believe the metaphor cost an arm and a leg originated in the world of art, it's more likely it was born in a time of war. The metaphor is a reference to the soldiers who lost a limb and thus had to pay a very high price in the war. Here's how the YouTube channel Easy British English explains it.
The origin of this idiom can be traced to one of either world wars. This is believed to be a literal translation for the cost of war, possibly costing you your arm and your leg. However, don't let this confuse you. You shouldn't use this idiom literally. This idiom also exists in other languages, but with slightly different variations. Here it is in German.
Das kostet ein Vermögen.
In French.
Ça coûte un bras.
In Polish.
Płacić jak za zboże.
In Italian.
Costa un occhio della testa.
In Spanish.
Me costó un riñón.
In Greek.
Μου στήχησε ο κούκος αηδόνι.
In Turkish.
Τζέπι ακμακ.
In Catalan.
Κουστά un ull de la cara.
In Arabic.
دفعت في دم قلبي.
And in Russian.
Влететь в копеечку.
So you heard all the different versions in other languages. But what do those versions literally translate to? Well, the German phrase translates simply to that costs a fortune, while the French saying means it costs an arm. The Polish version means to pay for something like for grain, while in Italian, the phrase means it costs an eye of a head. The Spanish say cost me a kidney, while the Greeks say the cuckoo cost me a nightingale. In Turkish, the common phrase is burns your pocket. And in Catalan, it's to cost an eye of your face. And just a reminder, we are talking about the English version of the metaphor to cost an arm and a leg. The Arabic version is, I paid for it with the blood of my heart. And the Russian translation says, burst into a kopeck, which is the smallest monetary unit in Russia. The metaphor, cost an arm and a leg, is a universal one, and every culture has their own understanding of the sentiment, as you've just heard. Sometimes metaphors can be profound. Our guest today believes in the power of the profound, and that finding simple solutions can make profound changes in one's life. My guest, Char Hibbert, invites you to invite abundance into your life. How? Listen on. So, Char, thank you so much for being a guest on Metaphorically Speaking. I'm excited to discuss your metaphor because it's one that I say many times. It's like the okay for me. You know, people say, okay. I say, arm and leg.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very familiar one. I must have heard that a lot growing up.
Great. So how does that metaphor resonate with you?
Yes. And as a money mindset coach, first two things come to mind. One, it resonates in the place of sacrifice for that what we refer it to, what we're actually purchasing, what we're doing. But also as a money mindset coach, it makes me reflect back on messages that we hear from growing up about money. And something costs an arm and leg can kind of make you feel that something is very much a sacrifice. It's way out of our reach. And that actually forms our...
But I'm thinking perhaps we can make it be inspiring for us. And
interesting.
Yeah. Like, even though something may cost an arm and a leg, we can say, well, we deserve it. We have worked towards it. It's something that I'm aspiring to get. I might be a child and I want to get this lovely car, which most young people want. They want a car or a house, which is important. But we could use it as a way to inspire people to say to the young people, well, okay, then if you want to get this car, it may cost an arm and a leg. You can't afford it right now, but you can work towards it. I've never really heard it being described in that way. Have you?
No, I've always heard it in the negative connotation rather than the positive one. So it's interesting you say it in that way. I think saying something that, you know, costs an arm and a leg, it really does go back to the fact of recognizing how much of a commitment you're making to this purchase. So if you are going to go for something that might be out of your reach, such as a very expensive shiny car, or, you know, maybe you want to put a deposit down for a house, something a bit more, you know, inspiring to do. Just recognizing, yes, it's great to have these things, but it's actually a huge investment. And that's why I go back to what I said before around one, the sacrifice, but is it a need or a want? An arm and a leg, if we actually lost an arm and a leg, would we really want that? So it's about recognizing the level of the impact you're going to have on what you're going to purchase. What's it going to do to your outcomes, your incomings? So you have to recognize that before you actually make that commitment to that.
You know, as you talk about it being a literal translation of, you know, costing an arm and a leg, we owe so much to all those before us, those with us who have lost their limbs, fighting for us or fighting what they believe in. Yes. And many of them have turned their lives around. And I'm afraid that no one's name comes to me at this moment. It could be because of all the rush that's been happening before I got here. But I do remember some people saying that, of course, they would not wish to lose a limb, but losing a limb or limbs have turned them into a person that they never thought that they could be. Mm. And their enjoyment of life is not what they thought it would be, and that they are actually enjoying their lives. So even in the literal sense, it can make someone happy. It doesn't sound nice the way that I'm saying it, but I hope that people understand that I'm saying it with the most respect.
Yes, no, I do believe, you know, through a journey, and maybe not necessarily one that we'll attract, but through particular journeys in our life, we can come out the other side better off through that development, through that journey. And something like that quite drastic in your life to have a change to your livelihood and, you know, everything. Yeah, I can imagine that would take you through a place and you may become on the other side a much better person. But I guess we just always can't take our eyes off the fact of the huge sacrifice that is. I mean, in most cases, the people we're talking about didn't have a choice. And if they had a choice of whether they had that leg or arm or leg removed, they probably would prefer not to. But we can't take away, you know, the value of what you just described there about someone having that transformative journey and, you know, coming out better on the other side. So I guess when we go back to the financial implication of what I was referring to earlier, you have to think about, you know, the journey you've taken to get to that purchase. If you're talking about maybe a young couple, for example, who wants to buy a house, the journey they've taken to get to the first deposit, raising that and getting the home and getting things sorted, it's taken a long time and it's taken a lot of sacrifice in other areas. So it may have cost them an arm and a leg to get to where they wanted to be, but that journey that they went through, that growth they went through, they probably was something they can't even imagine or even compare. You know, so they might not have gratefully liked it at the time, but it's something that they can cherish and remember.
It could also be seen as a form of value, because if we are talking to the fashion conscious, they may say, oh, if I get my brand label, then to me, I would say, oh, that costs an arm and a leg. But to them, it's not about how much it costs. It's about liking the design or wanting to be dressed in the label. So an arm and a leg could also be a personal value
in
some places with no monetary value apart from, okay, the price tag might be of a higher value than someone is expecting or someone may want to pay, but it's more about the personal value it gives them to be dressed in that. And also, it could be a store like Primark, for example. Everyone goes there. I mean, some of the best Christmas presents my friends told me that their children received were Primark vouchers. And I'm like, what? I couldn't believe that.
So it is about the person's own perception, I guess, in the sense of what is valuable to them. You know, what may be expensive to you may not be expensive to me, or what may not have value to you may have value to me. So it's about that personal value in the sense of what we put on something that we would say costs an arm and a leg. Somebody may say they don't agree with that, but to somebody else it may be that. So it's about that person standing in what they see as value. And understanding where that they place that in line of what will cost them an arm and a leg in the first place. Are we talking about a monetary value here, or are we talking about something a bit deeper?
And also having the respect for that value, because I mentioned Primark before, but these same people will say to me that they're going to buy their child, you know, a phone that costs £600 to £800. And I'm thinking, are you crazy?
Yeah.
You know? but at the same time, I have to respect if that's what they want to buy their child, and that's what they want to buy their child. And it's the same child that loves to have, you know, go to Primark and pick up a bargain. So it's all about having that value and respecting that person's value, which may not coincide with what you feel is valuable.
There's no better value than maybe feeling they can contact their child. They have that security and protection. They may feel that the phone will bring. You know, they may be able to put no cost on that, no value on that can match that. A sense that the phone costing £500, £600, knowing where their child is or be able to contact them at any time is probably more important to them. So, yeah, it's about the individual's personal values, really.
In your line of work, how would you see that metaphor fitting in if you had to explain it to someone?
I think I go back to my first comments around the sacrifice. So, yeah, sacrifice definitely comes into mind, because when we're talking about cost an arm and a leg, we think of expense. That's the first thing we're thinking of. And, you know, how does that involve the cost of something that we're trying to go for? You know, how does that impact our overall budget in and outgoings? You know, do we have a good overall understanding of our finances before we can actually say we're going to purchase something that costs an arm and a leg? It's crucial to evaluate the cost that aligns with your financial goals and values. So considering the long-term benefits versus the immediate sacrifice, is it something that is just for now? Is it really going to benefit you long-term? Does it go along with your long-term financial goals and aspirations? Or is it going to provide you with more stress to make ends meet, to meet this cost? So before committing to anything that costs an arm and a leg to that particular person, then we need to pause and reflect and ask ourselves, is the investment really worth it? You know, what kind of gain am I going to get from this? And going back to, is it a need or actually is it a want? Is it something I can plan towards, or is it going to make a drastic transformation in my life right now that I don't necessarily need? So we always have to think about making informed decisions when we align in our priorities. And you know, ensure that your sacrifices you make are pursuits of meaningful outcomes, not necessarily something that's just going to meet the here and now. That's the main thing that comes to mind as a money mindset coach.
Tell us more about your manifestation cards.
Oh, my manifestation cards. I'm glad to know you know about those, Delia. I hope you'll be getting involved with those cards soon. So basically, this month I've launched a challenge. I launched the cards back in March. And they are cards that's designed to help you to believe it, receive it, and achieve it. There's three types of cards in the pack of 31. And the cards are designed to give you a message from one money boss to another, to remind you to motivation message to keep you on track. And there's a task in there giving you actionable steps you can take to manifest every day finances into your life. And there's also affirmations in there as well. So giving you different type of affirmations that you can say every day, write every day, journal each day to get into the pattern of manifesting more money. Money is something people can sometimes feel is a negative word, or they're scared to invite more money or want more money. And as a money mindset coach, I say that's thinking in a place of lack and scarcity. So these cards are designed to help you to tap into the abundant source that's available to all of us if we invite it. So the 31-day cards is through 31 days of the month. And there's, as I said, those different types of ways of using them each day to keep you connected. And the challenge of the month of May starts today for 31 days is helping those who've purchased their cards to use it in a way that they're taking actionable steps to reach their financial goals.
Why did you think that cards were the way forward to try and get your message across?
I think because we often come across, within my line of work, I come across people that may, first of all, when I speak to them as a coach on money, they're ready to do the practical work, but not have done the homework around why they interact with money the way they do. So we need to home in on your money relationship, how you interact with money, what messages you may have heard about money growing up and how that may impact how you spend money, and what type of money personality type are you, you know, whether you're a saver or a spender, and how it's impacting your finances. So something such as a card forces you to take practical steps daily. So it takes away that thought of some people saying money mindset stuff and manifestation is wishful thinking. It brings you to a place of taking practical steps and activities, daily activities, that after a matter of time, you are training your subconscious mind to think in a certain way. And via my NLP training that I completed, this different type of tools you can use to do that, where you're actually helping someone to take away where they are now and transform into visualizing what they want and bringing that to fruition.
Did something happen to bring you to that money mindset, or is it something that you've always wanted to do?
Two parts of that. I think one, I've never necessarily felt that I've ever been without, and that could be times when I had less. Times when I've had more, I've always felt that it's always going to come back to me. I think that's always something that's always just been part of me. So I, you know, growing up, I see different people interact with money in different ways, and it made me question that. And then I started to think about the examples that I had with money. You know, I had a time in my life where I had £10,000 of consumer debt, and I cleared that in 6 months by working with a financial advisor. But without that support and guidance, I'd probably be making the same mistakes over and over again, which was using credit cards to live a livelihood and having no financial education coming out of the school system that teaches you about, you know, algebra and not really understanding interest rates and APRs. So I came to a place of knowing that I needed to do better for my family so they understand and learn from me. But also I wanted to change the narrative of women not really understanding money. So that's where I came to a point of creating She's All About the Money, to help other women and coach them through my NLP training to have a better understanding of money and get on top of their money. And I like to refer to them as becoming money bosses.
How do you think people should encourage themselves to purchase the manifestation cards, knowing that fear is a large part of not being able to manage money?
I think it's first and foremost is taking that step, just like anything in life. You know, we can complain about the same things over and over again, but then unless we do something brand new, we're not going to invite change. So I think the cards may be approached that someone's completely not really relatable to or something they've tried before. So it's about starting something new, starting afresh, and taking on this concept that's not really new, because it is, it's kind of combining different areas of what people have done before. You know, you might have gone to a workshop, for example, and taken on some learning, and then you have to implicate that, do that learning yourself in your own time. You may have had coaching sessions with somebody, but then you need to, you know, hold you accountable to those different tools that you've taken from that session. So having the cards is something you take into your own possession and in your own time, learn them and grow with them. But then what I've included with your purchase is that 31-day challenge that's helping you to get into that pattern and that routine of looking at those cards daily and taking action. So my advice would be to buy the cards and get started.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the most important words that you said there is accountability. I find that if before starting, if you say, I really want to do this and I'm going to find a way to be accountable, whether it's someone, because it's finances, people tend to think of it as a very personal thing. So they may not want to divulge personal information, but there might be someone, it might be a parent or a very good friend who is in the same situation. So you may say to your friend, look, you and I always, you know, living hand to mouth, waiting for payday, borrowing from each other. Let's do this together and let's be accountable together. Mm-hmm. Or perhaps you could, you know, start your own journal. Or there are lots of apps out there, really pretty looking apps that you can download on your phone and be accountable to your app. I think it's very important if you're serious about your money issues and even growth, not just, we're not saying that, you know, everything is negative, it's positive too. What I've seen from your cards, they encourage you, they inspire you. They tell you that you can do better. And, you know, you can go online and you'll see certain people who you could perhaps identify with who can say, not the ones that are all, you know, I did so and so and you know, those types. That you can say, yeah, I, you know, see someone in the community, someone like yourself, that they can follow and say, well, you know, they know what they're talking about. They've done there, they've been there, they've done that. And, you know, I think that the cards are a really good way for people to say, you know what, I do need to be accountable. I was afraid to start because I feel I'm going to fail. But you know what, I'm not going to. I'm going to find a way to be accountable to myself and to, you know, what's going on in my bank account. So saying all of that, it's really inspired me to look a little bit more about, you know, about your cards. I have looked at them. They're very pretty as well. You know, you have we are on radio. We are on podcast, so you can't visually see them. But if you visit the website that Chai is going to give you, you will see how beautiful those cards are. So how can people purchase and contact you?
Yes, that's a great message there. If you literally follow me on LinkedIn or Instagram, you'll be able to access the link that's in my bio. If you click on the link in my bio, it will take you straight to the purchase link. And this is how you can purchase the cards at the moment. We will be exploring other avenues there on from there. And just to reiterate what you just mentioned there about the cards being very pretty, I was very much key with the designer to ensure that the cards represented every woman. So the cards are designed in a way that every woman feels that they can connect to these cards. And, you know, there's a bit of an illustration that connects to each different type of woman, because we are unique in many ways.
Why women? What about the men?
Because that's my passion is women. And you know what? If men find these cards inspiring too, that's absolutely great. But literally my passion is to inspire more women to be money bosses and come control of their money. And I think for a long time, the reason why women's been highlighted to me is because I feel for a long time there's been this misconception that women are not necessarily on top of their money game, and they don't necessarily know how to manage money, and they rely on maybe their partners or, you know, their counterparts to manage money for them. And women are actually great because they can literally always make ends meet regardless of what they have coming in. They can feed a family of four.
Yeah, you know, you're saying this, and in my mind, I'm saying, I want to say this, and I want to say it properly. In my experience, a man and a woman, the same amount of money,
exactly.
Woman is going to make that spread further, and the woman is going to get you things that you need to survive.
Right. Yes. So, you know, I think it's often downplayed how great we are with finances. We just don't necessarily have that financial education, which I spoke about earlier, because the school system's not designed that way.
Well, thank you so much for sharing how an cost an arm and a leg resonates with you. I kind of forgot about it somewhere along the line because I was being crossed with the cards. But thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed that. I guess my main message really around the arm and the leg was around thinking of that sacrifice. If it's really worth it. But yes, if people like listening in, they like to get involved and work with me. My name's Shah Hibbert. And they can follow me at She's All About the Money on LinkedIn and all the socials, most particularly on Instagram. You can click the link in my bio. It'll take you straight to my page, which show you where you can purchase the cards and also book yourself a free 30-minute consultations call where I can speak to you about your finances and help you to stay on top of your finances and become a true money boss. So I hope to speak to some of you soon.
I think I'm going to be number one on the list. Thank you.
Cost an arm and a leg isn't the only metaphor that calls on body parts to make its point. There's also hot head, sticky fingers, getting cold feet, the list goes on. And what about the phrase, fingers crossed? Have you ever wondered where that came from? Here's what BBC Ideas has to say about it.
We cross our fingers for luck. We've been doing it for centuries. But why? Originally, the gesture needed two people. It was an ancient pagan custom for people to cross fingers with each other. They believed their wishes would be kept safe at the point where their fingers crossed, until they came true. This idea of capturing good fortune also explains the practice of tying string around a finger. For Celts and Anglo-Saxons, it would literally tether good luck to a person. The gesture also has roots within Christianity. When faced with persecution, early Christians would cross their fingers to invoke the power of Christ's crucifixion. And in a secret handshake, they would cross fingers with fellow Christians before gathering together in safety for Mass. The handshake made the Christian symbol of the ichthys, or sign of the fish. It's thought that Christians who were persecuted would cross their fingers to absolve themselves from the lies they told to their tormentors. And that is why we cross our fingers behind our back when making a promise we don't intend to keep. In England, in the 16th century, people crossed their fingers to protect themselves from evil coughs and sneezes. In a 1787 book of popular superstitions, it recommended keeping your fingers crossed after walking under a ladder. Until you see a dog. But it is the gesture's association with good luck that has stood the test of time. A recent University College of London study found that crossing fingers confuses the way our brains process pain signals, actually reducing painful sensations. And if that's true, then that would be a bit of good luck for everyone.
Many metaphors play on the use of parts of the body, but some are more grisly than others. Everything has a cost, but the image of having to use your body to pay for it is a morbid one. A famous example of this idea can be seen in William Shakespeare's play, The Merchant of Venice, believed to have been written between 1596 and 1598. In the play, when a merchant named Antonio defaults on his loan, a moneylender named Shylock demands the debt be paid in a pound of flesh. In this clip from the 2004 film version of The Merchant of Venice, Shylock, played by Al Pacino, proposes the contract to Antonio, played by Jeremy Irons.
You would lend this money, lend it not unto your friends, for when did friendship take a breed for barren metal from his friends? But lend it rather to your enemy, who, if he break, you may with better face exact the penalty.
Why, look how you storm. I would be friends with you and have your love. Forget the stays that you have shamed me with. Supply your present wants and take not a drop of interest for my monies, and you'll not hear me.
This is kind, I offer.
This is kindness.
No. This kindness I will show. Go with me to a notary and seal me there your single bond. And in a merry sport, if you repay me not on such a day, in such a place, such a sum or sums as are expressed in the condition, let the forfeit be nominated for an equal pound of your fair flesh to be cut off and taken in what part of your body pleaseth me.
Ooh, Shylock's proposal ends with such a gruesome idea. Today, the phrase pound of flesh is used to refer to an unreasonable ask or a debt that could only be repaid at great personal cost to the debtor. The phrase represents a harsh way of exacting payment. Maybe you've been in a position where someone like a boss or hopefully not a family member asked something so extreme of you, it felt as outlandish as asking for a pound of flesh. Lucky for us, there are metaphors to express just how dramatic we feel. It is interesting that the two disputed theories behind the phrase cost an arm and a leg stem from the worlds of war and art, two things that often intersect in life. Sometimes we're surrounded by both, another duality of the human condition. Art can be used to depict war, to protest it, or to promote it. Art is often commissioned by politicians or government regimes in the form of political cartoons or wartime propaganda, images meant to garner support for a leader or cause. Whether used in favor of war or against it, propaganda is powerful. Think of the staying power images like Rosie the Riveter or Che Guevara have. In fact, the phrase Napoleon complex was born of propaganda itself. The phrase refers to a short person who uses aggression or bullying to compensate for their lack of height. Napoleon was actually about 1.67 meters or 5 feet 6 inches tall, which was an average height for a Frenchman in the early 1800s. But British cartoonist James Gillray depicted Napoleon as short and arrogant in his satirizations of Napoleon's power-grabbing exploits. Gillray's political cartoons were so widely viewed that this idea of a small, angry Napoleon Bonaparte stuck in people's minds. Napoleon also tried to use propaganda to bolster his own image. Remember the hand-in-waistcoat pose Napoleon was fond of? That was one of many stances used to literally paint him as a great leader. Here's a clip from the YouTube channel The Canvas explaining how Napoleon used art to glorify his image and legitimize his power.
We can finally take a look at the most famous depiction of Napoleon ever created, Napoleon crossing the Alps. It was also made by Jacques-Louis David in 1801 and, of course, this picture is highly propagandistic. It's the depiction of Napoleon's invasion of Italy, which he courageously led through the Great St. Bernard Pass in Switzerland. He is shown here epically mounted on his horse, battling fierce wind, leading his men in rocky terrain. He carved his name in stone next to history's great leaders Hannibal and Charlemagne, both generals having led troops through the Alps. Napoleon is positioning himself, through this portrait, among the greatest conquerors of history. He is calm and confident, although his horse is eager and the wind is blowing strong. David is showing the French people and the world how strong and courageous of a leader Napoleon really is. But that was all fake. Once again, truth was traded for political gain, for power consolidation. Paul Delaroche, another French artist, decided in 1850 to recreate the scene in a more realistic way, in conformity with what actually happened. Napoleon didn't lead his troops through the Alps, but followed them a couple of days after they crossed. Not only was he not leading, he was being led by a peasant who guided him. Perhaps most importantly, Napoleon didn't cross the Alps on horseback, but on a mule. This is perhaps one of the biggest adjustments made by David in his original painting. Portraying Napoleon on a fiery horse is much more awe-inspiring than picturing him on a mule.
Many famous artists like Pablo Picasso and Francisco Goya have made anti-war art in response to a crisis of the time. Today, one of the most notable and prolific anti-war artists is Banksy. Banksy juxtaposes symbols of innocence with symbols of war, often in a satirical way. By placing his art in public places, his message is on display for all to see. Here's a video from the art dealing website, myartbroker.com, describing Banksy's impact.
Anti-war symbolism. Banksy's criticism is based on two powerful elements, potent symbolism and clever juxtaposition. Universal symbols of peace and innocence are often seen in stark contrast to violence, as evident in Flower Thrower, Happy Choppers, Have a Nice Day, and CND Soldiers. Children are repeatedly used as symbols of hope and innocence, set against the horrors of war, such as Kids on Guns, Bomb Love, and many of the murals Banksy's done in Ukraine.
Street art and activism.
Street art has long served as a politically charged medium for artists to express their beliefs in a public setting. Banksy, who has been working with stencils since the 1990s, continues this tradition, using public spaces to convey his hard-hitting activism messages. This practice is in line with other renowned artists, like Keith Haring, who used his art to protest the Iraq War and nuclear weapons during the Cold War.
Art is a way to speak out against war, but it's also a means to process war and can be healing to those who have lived through it. While the stories behind Cost an Arm and a Leg are different, the meaning is the same. Regardless of the saying's origin, its implication is clear. You must pay a very high price. The origins of the metaphor, cost an arm and a leg, may be grim, but how does this saying apply to everyday life, away from the front lines? What costs an arm and a leg where you live? Or rather, what would you pay an arm and a leg for? Maybe it's education or healthcare, or maybe it's a dream trip for Taylor Swift tickets. It seems unavoidable that sometimes things in life just cost an arm and a leg. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Metaphorically Speaking, as we considered the cost and virtues of an arm and a leg. We'd love you to share the show with your friends, and please feel free to leave a review on colorful.com or on our podcast, Metaphorically Speaking, which is on Apple, Spotify, and all major streaming platforms. If you'd like to reach us or suggest a metaphor for an upcoming show, you can reach us at info@metaphorically-speaking.uk. Join us for another metaphor next week. I'm Delia Delore. Keep safe. Goodbye.
Colorful Radio.
Tell me what you've been thinking. See it in your eyes. Don't need to talk to mine. Show me what I've been missing. See through your disguise. I think you should give it up. Oh.
This is Colourful Radio.
Hell yeah.
Satisfied.